Les conférences du Collège de France.
Bienvenue tout le monde. I'll start in French. Thank you for coming to the second lecture by Steve Quake. We're very happy to have him. His first lecture, for those of you who couldn't attend, is online, so you can also watch it. And so I won't introduce Steve all over again, especially because we need to try and keep to time today. But just to say that the second lecture is indeed going to be about mutations, mutagenesis, natural mutagenesis in the body. Well, who knows, natural or unnatural, but detecting it for sure. And I wanted to also mention that the next lecture will now be in September, as advertised. So the next lecture will be on the 8th of September, and the fourth and final lecture will be on the 22nd of September, just so that you all know. So without further ado, over to you, Steve. Thank you so much, and looking forward to it.
Thank you, Edith. Okay, so today I'm going to talk a bit about how mutations arise. Let me put this a little lower. How's that? In the body. And so just to refresh you, let's start where we started last time. About DNA being the molecule of inheritance. And we talked in the last lecture about the physical structure of DNA and also how it's used as sort of a parse list for cells because it encodes the sequences for all the proteins in our body. And the way it encodes that is through this chemical alphabet, adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine, ATCG. It's sort of remarkable that we now can read that out, and we've gotten very good at reading it out. So just to give you now a sense of DNA by the numbers again, this time not the physical aspects of the molecule, but the informatic content of the molecule. It takes about 5 million of these chemical letters or base pairs to create the genome of a simple bacteria like E. coli. And that's roughly as many letters are as in the complete works of William Shakespeare. So if you ask how much information do you need to code the smallest, sort of simplest organism, free living life people work with, it's about as much as William Shakespeare wrote. How about for humans? That's 3 billion base pairs, which is about as many letters are used in all of Wikipedia. That's how much you need to specify a human. And if you then start thinking bigger, how many letters are used in all the training data for ChatGPT? That's about 10 to the 12th. How about if you looked at all the works in the Library of Congress in the United States? That's about 10 to the 13th letters. And now if you ask, how much of the Earth's DNA has been read out using sequencers by human beings? That's about 10 to the 17th letters. So we've sequenced an enormous amount of DNA on this world. And if you ask what that corresponds to, you just do the division there. Scientists have generated an amount of DNA sequence equivalent to about 10,000 libraries of Congress. And you know, we, I would say, are not as good as reading the DNA alphabet and understanding what it means as we are reading literature. And so it sort of sets out a challenge for us. What does all that sequence information mean? And my good friend Rob Phillips, I credit him for doing these calculations. He is very much hung up on this question. And if you look at his lecture from Collège de France a couple years ago, he starts to get into this and does the derivations of these numbers in more detail in a recent lecture in the Simons Foundation, which is also available online. Okay, so that's roughly the scale of what you want to think about, the amount of information it takes to specify an organism from a single cell bacterium all the way up to a human. And we have this enormous amount of it now in databases and can think about it in different ways. And so we don't all have the same genome, all the humans in this room. We're all a little different from each other. And roughly 99.9% the same, but one part in 1,000, one letter in 1,000, we're all different. So that's what differentiates us as individual human beings. So those inherited mutations, which are more accurately known as polymorphisms, are, you know, sort of spread out among all of us. Now, within our body, our DNA changes over time. That's our inherited sort of genetic differences. Within our body, DNA changes over time for different reasons. One is that, you know, things in the environment cause mutations. If you're a smoker, that drives mutation. If you're exposed to certain chemicals, that creates mutations. Those environmental insults create errors in the DNA in some of our cells. And They're well known to be causes of cancer in the worst cases. That's one source of mutations throughout the course of our lives. Another one just happens because of random errors through cell division. Every time cells divide, there's a couple of mutations. Roughly one mutation per cell division is kind of the order of magnitude way to think about it. And most of those are harmless and don't have any biological effects, but they accumulate over time, and occasionally those mutations happen in crucial genes. And that's another cause of cancer, one that we really have no control over. That's just biology. Another cause of mutations are sort of when we're thinking about the next generation, sperm and eggs. They have mutations, sometimes due to cell division, but in other cases due to very directed processes of mixing your paternal and maternal inheritances through meiosis. And that creates genetic randomness and diversity in very interesting ways. So we're going to talk about all three of those sources in the course of the lecture today. Not all mutations happen for negative purposes. Some create positive changes, like there's mutations that create unusually strong bones, for example. There's other mutations that are sort of intentionally generated by the body. So in your immune system, when you're creating antibodies, there are biochemical processes that on purpose create diversity because you want to create antibodies that can respond to any novel substance you haven't seen before, novel pathogens, for example. And mutation is one way that the body does that. So that's an interesting process. That'll be the subject of the next lecture. A whole lecture will be about that sort of source of mutations. But the other three we'll talk about today. And as I did in the first lecture, I want to start with bacteria and go back to sort of model systems and sort of deep questions of how bacteria evolved before we get into the human case. And so I'm going to talk about a very famous set of experiments and questions about how mutations arise in bacteria that were done by Max Delbruck and Salvador Luria that won them the Nobel Prize. And again, there's a connection to Paris here. Luria, when he fled the fascists, spent a couple years in Paris at the Pasteur, which is where he learned how to do phage biology, which led to these experiments. So they asked questions, sort of very interesting question back in the day about the origin of mutations. It was unclear whether they arise randomly or whether they were sort of induced by the environment in a way to respond to unfavorable conditions. Delbruck and Luria decided to try to resolve that question of bacteria and answer this question of whether bacteria need to be exposed to viruses in order to display resistance to them, or whether they're just that resistance is already there. And this is kind of the mental picture to have. So in the world where it's induced mutations, the bacteria would have no resistance. They wouldn't have the mutation that makes them resistant to a virus or bacteriophage infection until they were exposed to it. And so a cell would divide in culture, and you grow up lots of cells, all of which are blue. None of them have the mutation to resist the virus. Then when you expose them to the virus, a few of them might get that mutation. And so if you look at the number of red cells, which are the mutated one, to the blue, you can see there's kind of a ratio there. Now, on the other hand, if it wasn't the exposure to the virus that caused the mutations, but rather the mutations arose randomly, you'd expect something a little different. As you grew up a culture of bacteria, eventually some would have a mutation arise randomly. And this one arose very late after many cell divisions. In this case, the mutation arose very early after the first cell division, and all the daughter cells had the mutation. This one, it never happened. This one, it happened somewhere in between. And so you can see that sort of the distribution, the numbers of red cells in any given experiment, is very different in this case than in this case. And so Luria and Delbruck worked out the math behind that. And you can look at sort of the variance over the mean, and they worked out a nice approximation here. And so this is a very clear prediction. If you do this experiment where you grow up a bunch of replicates of bacteria, then expose it to the virus, you'd expect to get very different answers in the distribution of resistant cells. So they worked out the formula, they did the experiment, and of course it's the case, not that the mutations were induced by exposure to the virus, but the other, that they occur naturally through cell division and they're just selected upon when exposed to the virus. So a very beautiful, elegant experiment to answer a very deep question about where mutations come from. And in the rest of the talk, we're going to kind of revisit that theme, but now in the genome age, where we have the power and the ability to sequence lots of DNA. So they had a very sort of clever way to do this using a model organism, a well-chosen trait, and they didn't need a sequence to get the answer. They got it from growing up the bacteria and looking at colonies. But now we can ask similar questions at a much larger scale for virtually any organism, including humans, and that's what we're going to talk about. Both the diversity that's generated through the creation of the next generation of humans, through sperm and eggs, through meiosis, and also through things that happen over the course of our lives that cause cancer. So let me take the next few minutes to talk a bit about the technology that we use to measure this. Sequencing technology has become incredibly powerful, and there's this famous sort of graph here of the cost of sequencing DNA per million bases of DNA or million letters of DNA as a function of time. This is the year here. And you can see it's been in the first part of the 21st century, it was dropping exponentially. Then it really accelerated, sort of super exponentially, and it's dropped many orders of magnitude. This is the famous Moore's Law from computers that show how fast the sort of computing power grows with time. And DNA sequencing went even faster than that up till about 10 years ago. Then it slowed down a little bit. So that's been amazing, and that's been kind of the driver of our ability to ask these questions, for example, in humans. So how do these sequencers work? The mental picture you should have of a DNA sequencer is that it's a microscope combined with a dishwasher. It's sort of that simple in concept. And, you know, it sort of, this transition that sort of broke through the throughput cost barrier was a real transition in sequencing when it went from being primarily chemical process using separations technology to a primarily biophysical process using fluorescence imaging. And so what happens is, actually, I'll show you in more detail here. The DNA is chewed up into little pieces by different methods, such as shearing. Then it's attached to a surface where it's amplified by PCR, so you have many copies of the same molecule in a given little grouping there, but different sequences spread out all over a surface. And you can see sort of what it looks like, random clusters over a surface, each one the amplified product of a single molecule. And then the way it's sequenced is it's made to be single-stranded and primed, and then you add one of the four nucleotides, having it fluorescently labeled with polymerase, and if it happens to match, that gets incorporated, and you can see fluorescence dots, and it lets you read out the identity of what base was incorporated in which cluster, and you cycle through all four bases in turn. That's why it's like a dishwasher. You're washing reagents in and out over and over again, each of the four bases, and you measure it, you cut off the fluorescence, and then you continue and do it over and over and over again, and as the strand grows, you can read out the sequence for each cluster under the spot. And it's really been just remarkably powerful. So how do you sequence a whole genome and put it together? The challenge is these molecules are pretty short, only a few hundred base pairs up to 1,000 base pairs. We discussed even simple genomes are millions of base pairs, not to mention humans, which are billions of base pairs. So there's been many clever techniques worked out to sequence these short molecules and put them together just like a jigsaw puzzle. And basically, it sort of schematically goes like this. You sequence molecules and then try to find out where they overlap in their sequence. And if you can find overlapping sequences, you kind of merge them together into contigs. And then you try to order the contigs by tricks that I'm not going to talk about right now into scaffolds. And eventually, you put it together literally just like a jigsaw puzzle. And there's a very famous formula that describes how deeply you need to sequence to do that, called the Lander-Waterman formula, based on Poisson statistics, and it says the fraction of genome you'll be able to assemble roughly goes like 1 minus the exponential of the coverage. But the coverage is how much you sequenced. So if the human genome is 3 billion base pairs and you sequence 30 billion base pairs, that means you've covered about 10 times the human genome. So the C would be 10 for that. And you can see that you will have covered a pretty large fraction of the genome. And so this is how you sequence a reference genome for the first time that's meant to be the average genome for, say, all humans. And then when you're interested in an individual human, you don't need to do the whole thing and assemble it from scratch. You can just sequence lots of short molecules and map them to the reference genome and see where they differ. So that's how you do resequencing of individuals within a species. And here's an example. If this is the reference sequence, looks like this in purple, and you've got many different sequencing reads that have come off from those little colonies on the sequencer, and they line up in different ways. This location here, which is the T in the reference, you see is a mixture of A's and T's in this individual. Okay, so that could mean a couple of different things. It could mean that it's a heterozygous site, and so because we're diploid, two copies of every chromosome, we got A's and T's. Or it could be a homozygous site and there's sequencing error. And that's why, to resolve these two questions, that's why you need to sequence pretty deeply, enough time so that you can see whether which of the two cases it is. And again, there's a very useful formula, a sort of combinatoric formula for working out what the distribution of different bases is within a given site, and it can tell you whether you got enough statistical power to answer this question. And typically, you're sequencing to depths of 50 to 100 times in order to get reasonable statistics out of this. So that's how you sequence genomes using bulk samples with lots of copies of the molecule from lots of the genome from lots of cells. And what we're going to talk about for the remainder of the talk is now doing this at the level of single cells to try to look at variation within an individual. And this has been a very powerful field. In the first lecture, I talked about sequencing transcriptomes from single cells. Now we'll talk about genomes from single cells. And it uses many of the same sort of technological components. First, the ability to sequence things, as we've just been discussing. Second, the ability to amplify. So we're in the previous talk, we talked about amplifying transcriptomes. We can use very similar biochemical amplifiers here to amplify entire genomes, so the DNA from single cells. I'm not going to go into the details of that, but I'm happy to answer questions about it. And finally, the ability to manipulate the single cells and put them where you want. It was a method of the year more than a decade ago, and is now done at scale. And again, sort of my involvement in this began with making the sort of microfluidic tools that allowed you to isolate individual cells, amplify their genomes, and recover that material for sequencing, and do this on lots of different cells at a time. And we started doing that initially, again, with bacterial cells. And that was the practice, smaller genomes, very interesting biological questions. Most bacteria can't be grown in culture. Most of what's in the environment can't be grown up in culture. And so it's been hard to study by conventional means. And we got interested in this question of, could we amplify genomes from single bacteria from the environment and learn things? And we did. And I'm not going to talk a lot about that, but here are several examples of that over time. What I do want to talk about now is humans. And let's start with human reproduction. How are we different from our parents in our genetic inheritance? We don't just pass on what we got. Of course, we have a partner, which is half of it, but even our own contribution. So there's a process called meiosis, which mixes together your own paternal and maternal inheritances. And it kind of goes like this. So most cells are diploid, so two copies of each chromosome. Here it's been simplified to imagine there's only two chromosomes. One is paternal, one is maternal. So this could be the DNA you inherited from your father, this from your mother. And what happens is, as these cells divide, matching chromosomes come together and then swap bits of their DNA molecules. And so you get mixtures, novel chromosomes that weren't part of your family before, mixtures of your own parental DNA. Then they separate again, and then they go from diploid to haploid, which is to say one copy of the genome in each cell. And when you then mate, the other half of the genome of your children comes from your partner, but your contribution is a mixture of your own parents here. And they're random in very complicated, interesting ways. So these big chunks have been swapped around, and that's why no kid, no child of yours is a perfect clone of yourself, in part because of this half of it. The other half is because there's another person involved, of course, but we're going to leave that aside for the moment. So the statistics of how this works are super interesting and have been studied at great detail. And the way they've been studied historically is to look at large family trees. So to look at multi-generations, track what's happened over time. And you know, it's been a very powerful sort of large-scale human genetics endeavor. We got interested in asking, could we ask the same questions within one individual person? Could we study the entire diversity that gets generated of potential offspring within one person? And this was work done by two terrific students in my lab, Christina Fan and Jianbin Wang. We thought if we could isolate single sperms from one individual, amplify the genomes, sequence it, we could understand something about how recombination worked in individuals and ask whether that was similar to what happened in populations. So experiments themselves are pretty straightforward in concept. First is to get sperm. That's done in the classical way. the sperm is put on a chip where different cells could be isolated in different chambers. And then on the chip, upwards of dozens of, I think it was 48 sperm amplified on each chip, so we could get lots of copies. Then it's genotyped or sequenced. And that sequence data is mapped back to the donor's genome. And we had sequenced, I was the donor in this case, we'd sequenced the genome and haplotyped it, which is sort of a something that was not typically done, and there was another sort of single-cell approach used to do the haplotyping. So we knew for this particular reference genome which parts came from the father and the mother. We had the whole set of sort of phased information along the chromosomes, and that let us map back from any given sperm. We could say which parts of the sperm map to the maternal and which parts to the paternal, and in fact, where the mixing had happened in the meiotic events. So that allowed us to really work out recombination events on each individual sperm cell. So we initially did low-density genotyping, where here each row is a different single cell's genome that have been amplified. Each column is a different locus in the genome. And we had two different alleles, A and B, for each site. And if two alleles were present, which is to say heterozygous, we know it wasn't a single sperm cell. So those are color blue. So you can see that the coloring here is all red and green, which says good single cells. We had one copy of the genome in each cell, not diploid, haploid, not diploid. Then we did very high density genotyping and could see that we were genotyping a good fraction of the genome from between a third and a half from each single cell with, many, many sites. From that, we could do the mapping I talked about. And for each single cell, we could make a figure like this, where the blue bars are places that were genotyped. This is one single cell. And you can see on the maternal and the paternal side what recombination event had happened. So most of chromosome 1 came from, let's call it maternal, a little bit at the end from the paternal. Chromosome 2 is a mixture in different ways like this. 3, there's only a tiny recombination event, and so forth and so on. And so this allowed us to actually compute these statistics across every chromosome, across every cell, and we could ask, what is the probability of recombination at any given point in the genome? That's sort of coarse grain, low resolution. That's what's shown here. This is sort of the cumulative probability distribution of recombination across 4 chromosomes. The circles are our data from this one single donor across many different sperm cells. The lines are what one gets when you study human populations, using sort of the conventional approaches. So there was large-scale projects called the HapMap and another one done in DECODE. And, you can sort of see they're pretty close. It's not that different. And in fact, you could do it for every chromosome. And at the end of the day, you see that the kind of random statistics of recombination that happen within one person are basically very similar to what happens to the whole population. And it's a bit like an ergodic principle. You can either measure lots of different people and average those results, or look at one person, look at that distribution. They're really quite similar. And it didn't have to be that way. So that was sort of cool to see. Now, this is sort of at low coarse grain resolution. If you look at higher resolution, you see that the recombination doesn't happen sort of uniformly. There's hotspots. This has been known previously. There's hotspots where recombination happens at much higher rates. There's sort of a dictionary of hotspots. And as we looked into this data from this one individual, we were able to find hotspots, things that were sort of statistically unusually high rates of recombination. Some were known, some were unknown. So we discovered a number of new personal hotspots. And this sort of indicates the power of doing the single cell measurements on given individuals. You can find hotspots whose activity is masked in the general population. And we were able to discover a number of new hotspots, which was really neat. So this data was all done with high density genotyping. We also did deep sequencing on some of these single cells. Here's one such cell sequenced to 8x coverage, so 8 times the sort of human genomes. You can work out how much e to the minus 8. 1 minus e to the minus 8 is how much we sort of more or less cover. So we mapped all that data back to the reference genome for this person and said, did it all agree? And so this is sort of the discordance ratio from the somatic genome for every single site of those 3 billion base pairs. And virtually everywhere it agreed with a reference, which is good. So the single cell faithfully reproduces the genome of this individual. But when you see a little bump down there, and when you zoom in here and blow up this part of the axis, you can see that not everything agreed 100%. there's, you know, 10, 20, 30% disagreement at some very rare number of locations in the genome. And that's what you'd expect from technical error in the experiment. Errors in amplification, errors in sequencing, and such forth. This is not biology, this is just technical. But if you go all the way out to here, you see, whoa, there's a small number of places in the genome where about 100 places where the discordance ratio is 100% wrong. Like at that site, every single read disagreed with the reference of that individual. That was like, we spent a lot of time trying to understand that. We convinced ourselves it was not technical error, but those were places where that sperm cell had a mutation that was different from the reference genome. So that's a place where somewhere in the spermatogenesis there had been a cell division, mutational error, and this would be a new mutation that, if it was passed on, if there was a child made from it, it would be different from the parent. And a new mutation would have been introduced into humanity. So that was pretty neat. So these are de novo mutations. We sort of repeated the sequencing across a number of different individual cells. And if you convert the number of changes to a rate, it looks like this. So it's about 3 times 10 to the minus 8 probability of getting a de novo mutation, which is a little higher than what people had thought from sort of bulk measurements of sequencing parents and children. So there's some literature on this. Our rate came out a little higher than that. But, you know, there was sort of this sort of thought in the field that the mutation rate would depend on age. And the older you were, the higher the rate would be. So there was maybe a way to explain this. And so we sort of took a deep breath and published this data. And we said, we think we've done the best possible job we could in taking away the experimental technical errors. We think this is the true biological variation measured from single cells. Unbeknownst to us, at the same time, Decode Genetics was asking a very similar question, but in a totally different fashion. They were sequencing parents and children, and lots of parents and children, and working out, because Iceland has this giant genetic registry, and they were working on mutation rates by looking at de novo mutations in the children relative to the parents. And they published their paper roughly about the same time as ours, and we didn't see any of their data before we published ours. So we were then able to superimpose our data onto theirs and see what happened. So this is their data here. This is they did many families, and they were able to show that the number of mutations was dominated by the father, not the mother. And so they had fathers of various ages, and this is sort of how it all scattered. And our data happened to sit right on the curve. It was amazing. One of those very cool times in science where the same thing was measured in completely different ways without talking, and the answers were consistent, which gives one a lot of faith in it. So very cool. Okay. Let's talk now about cancer and what happens in the case of cancer. So there's sort of this mental picture that the steps to cancer are random mutations that are accumulating, either from cell division or from insults from the environment. And as your cells divide, you gradually accumulate more and more mutations. So you might get one here in yellow, then these cells that have yellow mutations might get another one in red, then a third one, then a fourth one, and eventually you get enough mutations that the cells stop behaving normally and they become cancer. They divide without restraint. And at that point, you can call it a tumor cell, and these will grow wildly and cause disease. And we got interested in the question of what happens before the tumor takes over. What are the mutations that are happening when the cells are still normal? And we're going to look at the case of leukemia here. So these are leukemic stem cells. And we're going to look at the hematopoietic stem cells, the cells that make the blood, which are not part of leukemia. And this sort of matters practically for a bunch of different reasons, one of which is that it's not uncommon in cancer to cure it temporarily for a while, then there's a relapse. And the question is, what causes the relapse? Is it due to a picture, two possible pictures. One is that the treatment didn't kill all the tumor cells and they just grow back or grow back differently. Another possibility is that the treatment was totally successful, but these sort of normal cells that are tipped just before becoming tumors are still there and they only need another mutation or two and the relapse happens there. So this ability to sort out what's happening and the mutations that happen in their order in the normal cells hopefully will help us understand important questions about how you treat the disease. So we did this work in collaboration with Ravi Majeti, At Stanford, and our postdocs, Max Jan and Tom Snyder, were the ones doing the work. And so here, I'll just talk about some of the sort of technical details. So these patients had leukemia, and we sequenced the tumors to figure out what the tumor-specific mutations were using bulk sequencing of those cells. Looked at their and used the got the normal genome from the T cells, so could compare tumor to normal and validate in this way, get a picture of the sort of portrait of mutations of the tumor for, that was personalized to each patient. Then from each patient, we purified the normal hematopoietic stem cells and did the grew colonies from them. So this is before we really had the this. In this case, we were able to use a trick and grow colonies as if they were bacteria, just because of the special properties of these stem cells. And then genotyped them, and were able to look at which mutations from the tumor were present in which of the normal cells from their blood. So let's look at some of the data. This now is the bulk data. And so if you sequence in bulk the tumor, these are mutations that came up. And were single mutations that are heterozygous, so 50% there. So evenly at 50% across all these mutations. Now, in the tumor itself, in the normal cells, you could see some of the mutations were there in the normal cells, but at a very low fraction. And this is true no matter which patient we looked at. Okay, so each patient. The tumors are different mutations in the tumor, so the genes on this axon are on this axis are different for each patient, but the principle is the same. You can see that the tumor has the mutations at a very high level because they're present in basically every cell, but these normal cells, some small fraction of them also have some of these mutations at different levels. And you have no way of knowing which mutations are in which cells, which coexist, because they're all mixed together. These are bulk measurements on lots of cells at once, so there's no way to tease out which cells had which mutations from this sort of measurement. But you can from the single cell measurements. So we did those, and here is one way to kind of look at it. So these are three axes here. There's one mutation on this axis, two on this axis, two on this axis. And these pairs always co-occurred in this data, and these always co-occurred, which is why they're on the same axis together. Each cell that we measured is put into a different quadrant here, depending on which mutations it had. Most of the normal cells had no mutations, so they're down here in this corner, so almost 500. 54 cells had this one mutation in it, but not the others, so they're here in this quadrant. Three cells had this mutation and these two, so they're in this quadrant, and one cell had all of them. And when you think about this, only these quadrants are occupied, which means there's a Venn diagram that lets you work out exactly the order of mutations that happen biologically, and it was like this. So this was like the first way to look at a true naturally occurring cancer in an individual human and work out the order of mutations that happened early on to cause that mutation. It must have been like this. SCIP2 was first, then ELP2 and PDZD3 happened at some point. We don't know which order those happened. We don't have enough resolution. Then FLT3 happened CNDP1. The order could not have been anything else because we don't see other colonies, other quadrants occupied. It's like a perfect Venn diagram. And then at some point, there were more mutations, and these became not normal, but tumor cells. Same thing happened with this patient. Different sets of mutations on the axis, but the same pattern. You see the Venn diagram is such that it only could have happened this way. Here, TET2 and E1357 stop happen, then these two, then these, and at some point after that, more mutations in the tumor happen. This gives a sort of picture of what one can do. It's a very powerful way to look at the natural history of any cancer and any tumor. We were able, in this case, we were working with leukemia because we had that special ability to grow those cells, and that was how we got at the information from the normal cells. But with today's methods of amplifying from single cells, you can do this for any tumor you like. It's I think, going to be a very powerful way to help understand the earliest causes of tumors. Let me give you another example now. This is also blood cancer, ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukemia. This is the most common pediatric cancer. There's, 3,000 new cases a year in the U.S. The cure rate is pretty good. About 80% of the kids are cured. But the fact that this is a high incidence makes it sort of the leading cause of child cancer death. And it happens very young. Kids are very young, 2 to 3 years is the peak, but it can happen for older kids as well. So people studying the bulk tumor samples here and doing genetic analysis of this had worked out, kind of at low resolution, that there's a clonal structure, a set of mutations that happen. And in some very interesting work, it was worked out, people studied what was the genetic property of the tumor when it was first diagnosed, and then what was the genetic property later for the kids that had relapse and the cancer reoccurred. And what they found was the genetics weren't the same. Only about 8% of the time did it look the same. But like a third of the time, it had clearly evolved from the clone that was the original one. About half the time, a very distant relationship. And their finding was that there was evolution from some ancestral clone very early on, earlier in the process, earlier in the disease. So the therapy had killed the sort of dominant clone, the biggest part of the tumor, but earlier parts were still there and they'd evolved into something different. And a small fraction of the time, it was totally different. So we decided to try to look at this now from the perspective of single cell measurements see if we could work out the actual clonal structure directly. This has been inferred indirectly in this work, but we wanted to measure it very directly. So in this case, we did something reasonably similar to the other experiment where we sequenced the tumor, the bulk part of the tumor, to look at where the mutations were. And then we, in this case, used the single cell microfluidic amplification to amplify whole genomes from many single cells of the tumor, and then resequenced the parts of the tumor where there were interesting mutations that we knew from the bulk measurements. And so from that, we were able to work out the clonal architecture of the whole thing. And so to give you a sense of sort of the power of this and why we did this rather than the bulk measurements, here's what the allele frequency looked like in the bulk tumors, okay? And so you can see that there's a bunch of mutations that aren't present in every cell in the tumor. That's what it means to have a clonal structure. Not every cell in the tumor is the same. Some mutations are found in the entire tumor, and those are the ones that happen earlier on, like we studied in the previous example. But as the tumor grows, it mutates, and not every cell is the same. And so clearly there's different genetic structure here, but you can't work it out from a low-resolution picture like this. All you know is that there's heterogeneity there, and it's impossible to deduce the true clonal structure. But when you measure the mutations in single cells and look at which mutations are correlated together, you can get a figure like this. So here, every row is a different single cell. Every column is a different part of the genome where we're looking for mutation, and red is mutated, white is not. And what you can see is there are really sort of three different cell populations within this tumor. There's the ones that have these mutations, the ones that have these mutations, and the ones that have both. Okay? So two dominant clones along with some ancestral clones. Whoops, sorry, let me go forward again. So basically, these are the clones that are the mutations that are your ancestral ones shared with all the cells. These are the ones of one clone, these are the ones of another clone. So the phylogeny looks like this, two dominant clones in this tumor that are related through these shared mutations in the ancestor. Here's another patient, same story. You look at the bulk data, none of that structure is really apparent. But when you look at the individual cells, you can see it's very interesting and different than the other one. Here's one clone, here's another one that's related to it but has some different mutations, and here's a completely distinct one. And so the phylogeny looks something like this. Here's the three clones, these two closely related, derived from a common ancestor. This one's much more distant, but they all have a common ancestor which shares all of these mutations. And so in this way, you know, we can look at, in this case, six different patients. We can make figures of each. This was work done by Chuck Awad and Winston Coe in the lab. And from each of them, we can build this clonal structure, and we know the order of mutations in the history here within the tumor itself. It's very interesting. You can see that some sort of famous oncogenes are popping up here sort of late in the evolution. Where is the one? There's a good one here. I don't see it right now. Oh, KRAS right here. So here, KRAS occurs sort of late and in one clone and not the other. And so that's a famous cancer-causing mutation. For this clone to continue to compete, there must be a mutation that has a similar effect in a different gene that allows it to continue to grow. And so you can deduce sort of interesting things of what must have happened in the kind of evolutionary history of the tumors by looking at the individual genes and the stories behind them and when they occurred in the history of the tumor. So in this way, you know, it's not so different from the way Darwin thought about evolution, right? Except this is his lab book, famously, in the Tree of Life. Here you can build similar phylogenetic trees, and there's pressures on these tumors. People have theorized about this for a long time, and this provides a very direct way to measure and study it in actual humans. So, again, a really sort of powerful experimental approach to understand mutations in our body in the case of sickness. Just a couple more comments, and then we can have discussion. So when you think about these sorts of measurements, even though the cost of sequencing have dropped enormously, it's still very expensive to sequence whole genomes in many different single cells. Cost of a genome now is a couple $100s. So it's if you want to do lots of cells, that starts to add up. And so if you think about what one would want to do in an experiment, you can sequence just a portion of the genome or the whole genome. So this is like an axis which characterizes people's work in the field by the fraction of the genome sequence from each single cell. And this axis tells you the number of cells you study. Ideally, you want to be out here looking at whole genomes and lots of single cells. But, you know, you have to make experimental design choices. Most folks decided, you know, we'll focus on a small number of cells and sequence very deeply. You saw what we did that in our sperm example. Lots of other folks did. That's our paper right here. Other folks made similar decisions. But in the last example, we did it the other way. We focused on only the mutations that were interesting for the tumor and looked at a small subset of the genome, but the one that really mattered for each patient, and then did lots and lots of cells. And so you can see the sort of trade-offs one can make in doing this and the reasons why you would do it. And this is a review article that we wrote about the field a few years ago. So the last thing I want to talk about is this question of mutations that occur through aging, most of which are benign, and another way to make these sorts of measurements from single cells. So in the previous lecture, we talked about sequencing the transcriptome, and I took you through lots of data there, both on model organisms and in humans. I had mentioned that in our mouse study, we looked at aging. So in the tabula murus, we looked at mice of different ages, going all the way from 1 month up to 30 months. A 30-month is an extraordinarily old mouse. It's roughly the same as a 100-year-old human. So it's like a centenarian. And we wondered if it was possible to see mutations that accumulated over the course of the lifetime of these mice. And because we've been sequencing the RNA, in principle, we should be sensitive to mutations that happen in the protein coding parts of the genome, and we might see them in the data. That's a small fraction of the genome, but we thought, you know, with enough age, maybe they'd be there. And sure enough, we were able to see sort of increasing mutation levels with age. And so these are different cell types. This is all the cells. This is broad different cell types. And we're looking at mutations relative to the 3-month-old mice. We looked at the 18-month-old and the 24-month. 30 is not here, but 24-month is also quite old. That's like an 80-year-old human, I think. The unshaded histograms are the false mutations due to technical errors in the measurement. We worked out some ways to measure that very directly. So this is like the noise level. And you can see that the histograms are starting to move well beyond the noise as the mice get older, particularly as they get to 24 months. And so you can see the spectrum of mutations that's happening naturally with age. And you can look at it as a function of cell type. We're starting, you know, having sort of done the first crude version of this in mice, we're now starting to think about how to look at this in our Tabula Sapiens data in human, and I think that story is going to be very interesting. So I think I'll summarize here, and then we can have discussion and questions. I hope I've convinced you that we can now study these genomes at the single cell level, and we can use it to look at a variety of interesting aspects of human biology, from recombination and meiosis and how we create genetic diversity in our offspring, to the mutations that lead to cancer when cells are still normal, to understanding the actual genetic structure of a given tumor and how that changes over time. And so this philosophy embraced by Lurie and Delbruck early on of using sort of quantitative measurements to understand how particular mutations arise, in their case in bacteria, are now very highly generalized by these tools to do in the genome age. And you know, DNA is fun to think about, and you know, it's very seductive. But there's often, you have to be careful working in the field. There's a great quote here from Maurice Wilkins that I'll leave you with, and those who know the history of it, I think, will appreciate it. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.